Welcome to End of an Era, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and we are moving nicely on to part four, I believe, of the End of an Era series. And what an episode this one is going to prove to be, I have no doubt. Luckily, I have two of my closest friends and confidants for this episode. Before I introduce the subject and the special guest, I'm just going to ask for some reassurance from the two co-hosts that they're not just going to leave me high and dry on this episode. So first of all, Stephen, welcome. Series, this is your responsibility.
I know. Exactly. I'd take full responsibility. But if you find that I'm on 20-minute mute at one point, then yeah, don't be surprised because I've gone off for a beer. But no, actually, this is going to be an absolutely fantastic podcast because it's a recognisable name to kind of like seasoned kind of like Italian football observers, but yet know very little about. So it's been a fantastic voyage of discovery. And within that, it didn't take much to be a voyage of discovery. As soon as you found out the first fact about them, then you knew more, 100% more than I did before I came to look for what they did. So it's got to be a brilliant one, this.
I can definitely confirm, as you say, the minute I typed the name in, I already instantly knew more than I ever did know.
Yeah, automatically knew so much more. And I've got a Peroni for my suspects in this one as well. So yeah, I feel adequately prepared.
Well, that'll help. That'll help massively. Gary, this has got all the feeling and hallmarks of a political football episode where certainly myself. And you and I, to a certain extent, would just sit there and essentially just be educated for an hour.
Ditto, buddy. When Stevie came up with this brilliant idea for the series of, you know, End of an Era, you know, we were looking at teams in those clubs in the sort of last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. But, you know, this one takes us to an entirely different era. And, you know, as we said in the political football podcast so many times, still, you know, every episode is a school day, and this is going to be another one. So it's a fascinating subject, and you know, I'm delighted to sort of be involved in this and sort of listen to things that I didn't know about Italian football that we're going to learn from our guest today.
We're definitely going to learn of that. I have absolutely no doubt.
I should say that I have got a Peroni. I've got an Astra Galicia. Beer in front of me, so it's Spanish, but you know, it's near enough, so it's meant to be.
I feel like I'm missing out. I'm just sat with a cup of tea. I feel like I'm really missing out.
Someone's got to stay sober, Stu.
Well, we have on this one.
Designated driver.
That's me. Designated driver of the podcast. Okay, so let's make a start then. So in this episode, we're talking about Pro Vercelli, one of the early pace setters of Italian football in the pre-Serie A era. They were national champions seven times by 1922, giving them more league titles at the time than Milan, Internazionale and Juventus put together. However, relegated by 1935, never as yet to return to the Italian top flight. So how come this once dominant era came to such an abrupt end? And I'm delighted to say that we've got somebody on who knows about it. So that's a great start. Matthew Gibbs, welcome to the End of an Era series. And first of all, before we even start, thank you for what I assume is going to be an hour's worth of free education.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on. No pressure. it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fascinating. And I need to say sorry ahead of time because I'm going to butcher the Italian language tonight. All of these pronunciations, all these names, it's going to be terrible.
Oh, I'd be fine, don't worry. We'll put it through like an auto tune. It'll just give you a fake Italian accent. Nobody will know, it'll be fine, don't worry. So obviously, Matthew, you know, you know, when Stephen put this out, you know, put the idea out, and, you know, and as Gary said there, you know, we've had the very sort of traditional sort of end of eras that, that people would instantly spring to mind, you know, relatively contemporary eras that have come to an end. And then you've arrived with this incredible club, this incredible story. What made you pick this?
Well, to be honest, we have another these Football Times writer to thank for this, Will Sharp. He's the one who introduced the team to me, and I'd quite literally never heard of them before about 6 months ago, 9 months ago, when he mentioned it in one of the chats that we have. And then it's like you say, you put the name and you look at their history, and it's like wow, like this team with this much history, with seven titles, exists, and they're sort of floundering down in Serie B, Serie C. It's an amazing story, and I don't know if there are too many stories like this in football, like ever, anywhere in the world.
I'll start off with an easy one for you, Stephen. This is, you know, and I'm sure it's something that we're going to get onto, you know, later on, looking at comparisons of other clubs. But it's great that somebody's, you know, sort of not necessarily gone out on a limb here, but have sort of taken a different fork in the road, shall we say, and, you know, and really sort of gone for it in a way that, you know, just because this story resides, you know, nearly 100 years ago, makes it no less of an impact. It makes it no less, what's what I'm looking for? Serious, you know, makes it no less, you know, no less gravitas to what happens to this club.
Oh, completely. I mean, there's a certain, I don't know, a certain magic about these type of clubs. You know, if you have a historical football in mind, or if you write anything, you know, you will go into your research and you will look for, you know, the backstory of a club or the backstory of a player. So within that, you know, if you come to write something about Milan or Internazionale or Juventus or any of the, you know, the perceived, not even perceived, the indelible giants of the Italian game that have stretched across many, many decades and remain contemporarily significant, you will go back and look and see, well, where did the title winning start? Where was it? You know, how many did they win? And you kind of like chart, and then you see these names pop up and you think, Provincelli, what's this about? Because then you're thinking that's like a vast array of success that they had in a relatively short space of time and then sunk without trace. And there's something fascinating about that. You know, within the same sphere, you know, you can look at Genoa, who kind of went toe-to-toe with Provincelli over this period of time. They won, you know, a similar amount of Italian league titles up until this point that Provincelli fall off the radar. Yet, in contemporary terms, the city of Genoa means Sampdoria to so many. Yeah, Sampdoria have only ever won one title, one Serie A title. And there's Genoa on, what, 8, 9? So, you know, in historical terms, Genoa are the big, significant club from their city. Yet in contemporary terms, they are very much in the shadow of Sampdoria. Yet here is Provincelli. And they are, you know, just a wonderful mystery.
Gary, it's, you know, we've done so many political football, we've done historical, well, you know, we've travelled the world a lot, and we've gone backwards and forwards in time quite a lot as well. And I think, you know, as you like to say, you know, if history teaches anything, it's that it's very repetitive. You know, this is ultimately a story that's, you know, that you could argue is happening now, you know, potentially with the likes of maybe Arsenal, Manchester, maybe not quite so much. Maybe not, that's probably a bit too dramatic actually, but there are clubs who have sunk without trace. Maybe look at Coventry or, you know, and yet this was happening 100 years ago.
Yeah, this is, you know, one of those strange football discussions where even I am not old enough to remember it.
Oh, no.
but, as you say, you know, and we sort of discussed this many times, that, you know, football has this sort of tendency to repeat itself, and, you know, there's eras of domination where clubs become the most potent force in a national arena, and then they fall away. And the key interest of this, and this is the beauty of Stevie's idea of this series, reasons why they became prominent and the reasons why they fell away afterwards. And this is going to be a fascinating discussion about a club that, you know, for so many football fans, and I include myself in this, knew very, very little about this this club. And yet it was one of the major powerhouses of the early years of Italian football.
Exactly. And I think what we're going to need from you now, Matthew, is just a little bit of an overview of, you know, I mean, Stephen's alluded to a little bit there. He's got all his research out of the way and in early. I know what he's done. I know exactly what he's done.
I've powered him and gone early there, though. But I'm going to be desperately scrabbling around for something else now.
But, you know, if you can just sort of put into, you know, the context of the time and a little bit of an overview, you know, and even just put this club into context for us.
Yeah, so so as we've talked about, this was a club that was dominant in the very early years of Serie A. The first title they won was in 1908. And Italian football looked a little bit different back then. Like they didn't have the Serie A as what you do now. It looked a bit more like a knockout tournament. It grew over the years up until like 1908, where the Italian Federation took a quite controversial decision to split the competition. So there were now two competitions. Since football began in Italy, there was this perceived problem with foreign players. The Italian historian John Foote, who's quite literally written the book on Calcio, says this is mostly down to jealousy because Italy were a bit behind, you know, a bit behind England, a bit behind France, a bit behind other leagues when it comes to that football. But this was also just 10 years before Mussolini would form his National Fascist Party. So nationalism and fascism is on the rise in Italy at the time. So you have these two championships. You have the Italian Championship, where only Italians are allowed to participate. The winners of this would be called the Campioni d'Italia, Italian champions, while the other championship was called the Federal Championship, where foreign players who lived in Italy at the time would be allowed to play. Because of this, a lot of the bigger teams like Milan, Genoa and Torino all pulled out. And it's hard not to see this as beneficial to Provincelli, as they only had to play in this 1908 league, they only had to play in like a mini league against US Milanese, who was the first name for Inter Milan, and Andrea Doria, which is the early iteration of Sampdoria. So they only had to play four games, and they won two, drew two, and were crowned champions of Italy for the first time. To say that the withdrawal of other teams helped Provincelli, it's difficult to say, but they never looked back from there. And so when a league system was introduced a year later, they finished joint top with Internazionale, where these two would then meet in a championship playoff game. And this is where a fair bit of, you know, Italian controversy starts to come into play. Because on the day of this championship playoff game, Provincelli, a lot of Provincelli's squad were committed to a military tournament on the same day. They requested that the game be rescheduled, but Inter Milan said nope. And out of protest, Provincelli fielded their fourth team, which was made up of supposedly players as young as 10. And they were completely annihilated by Inter 10-3. But this didn't really stop them in that sort of conquest of domination of Italy, because the next two seasons there would be relatively comfortable championship wins for, their nickname was Il Leone. So it clearly didn't throw them off too much at the time.
Sorry, it's great that we have a little bit of context now. And we certainly have, you know, context with regards to, you know, the era, if you like, and the structure of the competition. And I guess, you know, Stephen, sometimes, and you know, I suppose when you compare it to English football and, you know, the English Football League and, you know, how long that's been around and how, you know, the assumptions that some people make that therefore all European leagues were as well structured, well organised, you know, the amount of teams, the competitive nature of it, you know, you make that assumption, rightly or wrongly, that in the other sort of European, you know, powerhouses of football, you know, like you say, like Italy, like Spain, like France, like Germany, you know, you make this assumption that it was very, very similar, maybe, you know, slightly a little bit behind in terms of time, but it would be very much just follow the English template.
You do, and it's surprising in a way. It does take you aback when you first stumble across the fact that there wasn't a Serie A until, what, the late 20s, early 30s. It was the same for La Liga. You know, you didn't have the Bundesliga as we know it didn't start until what, 1962, 63. So prior to that, you had a lot of regionalized leagues, and then they would come together into like a national finals towards the end of it, and then there would be a, you know, a definitive championship playoff in these leagues, and Italy, you know, fell into this category. You know, this was a system that decided the German champions all the way up to the early 1960s. So, you know, for English football to be sat there all high and mighty from the late 1880s with the systematic league and domestic cup and all of this, then yes, you know, here they were, the empirical kind of spreaders of the game, the organisational side of it. I mean, we've spoken on the South America files with the brilliant Dr. Pete on how, you know, leagues are formulated over in South American nations, and how some have been a lot more scattergun, yet some, like Chile, seem to have it quite nailed down very early. So, yes, it is intriguing that things like, you know, like Italy ticks that box, where it's, I don't know, perhaps much more like the early foundation of football in South America before they do get to that kind of like 1920s, 1930s zone, where they look towards how it's worked in England, how it's worked in Scotland, how, you know, French football is blossoming, and the organisational side of it, and they adapt and they change.
I'm going to ask you a question here, Gary, and I think I'm pretty sure I think I'm going to know your answer, but I'm going to throw it out to you anyway. In terms, obviously, about based on what Matt said, you know, and how the, you know, the championship was split, and then sides that withdrew from the competition, and you know, thereby leaving, you know, four teams. Do you think people looking back will detract or from the perception of the success that they had? Will it become, you know, not, I don't mean necessarily mean a footnote, but you know, if you're only playing against, you know, three other teams to win a championship, does that detract? Or, and I know a lot of things, you can only play what's there. You can only play, you know, you can only play to the rules of the tournament. If that's what it was, then that's what it was. But I just wonder whether the lack of maybe awareness of this side, or maybe it's just myself that is just a little bit unaware, but whether the lack of awareness of this side has anything to do with how potentially the structure and the format of the championships that were won, whether that has impacted on their legacy. I always seem to use this word all the time. I'm really sorry. Whether that's impacted in any way.
I guess there's two answers to that, Stu. And, you know, you know what I'm going to say is the first thing is the only beater is in front of you, and that's what they did. But I'd be interested to hear Matthew's thoughts on the relative strengths of the other clubs that opted for the other league, shall we say, the non-purely Italian league, the Federal League, as to, you know, compared to the league that Pro Vercelli were in. It's a real strange situation where you have to, I wouldn't say competitive leagues, they're not competing with each other, but two leagues in the same nation that are separate not for because one's better than t'other, but because they're different. But I'd be fascinated to hear what Matthew thinks that the comparative strengths of the two different leagues. If that's passing the book on the answer to your question, I'm sorry, mate.
No, it's right. We've got a specialist in Gary, don't worry.
Indeed.
It is interesting. It is interesting because the federal championship was only made up, well, initially only made up of three teams, which was, if I remember, Andrea Doria and Juventus, because Milan withdrew from it. So again, there's only two teams in that other division. I think because there was a big controversy at the time about the whole split in the league. A lot of clubs weren't happy, and they sort of withdrew out of protest. And then I believe they came back for the next one. 1909 was a little bit bigger, not that much bigger, but a little bit bigger. But I do agree with that. It impacts a little bit on this particular victory because it definitely helped Pro Vercelli. I mean, if you only have to beat two of the teams who's in the division with you, it makes life a lot easier, I guess. But I think what's more impressive is how they then went on to win like four of the next five championships from this. It didn't stop them. Like, maybe the first one was a bit of good fortune, but they sort of doubled down and proved that they were the most dominant team in Italy at the time.
It's, I mean, I suppose part of me wants to say I'm quite relieved about that, because I don't want, you know, this is such a great story and it's such a fascinating story, and you sort of, I'm sort of desperate for, I feel like I should join their fan club. I feel like there should be more awareness of this side. And, you know, yeah, obviously, you know, if you can carry on the story, Matt, and, you know, and sort of really emphasise actually just how good this side were, just how dominant they were, and just almost how groundbreaking it was, and, you know, and how they should be remembered, they do deserve to be remembered. You know, their legacy should be intact. It should be, you know, as Stephen's mentioned there, you know, more Italian championships than Roma. It's, you know, these are the thing. These are the stories, and I'm sure Gary and Stephen will agree with this. You know, these are the stories. It's crucial that these stories are kept alive, that are retold.
I totally agree. I think they're definitely a team that, I mean, I've become quite affectionate of them since finding out about them. I look out for the fixtures and everything now. I think there's definitely something about them. There's something, there is something about this club where, because there's not much English language information about them, there's not much information about the glory years. It adds a bit of mystery, a bit of legend, like a bit of a mythical quality about them. But to carry on the story, so in 1910, this is the year that the farcical final happened with Inter. It looked a bit more like Serie A. There was nine teams in the division, and so 16 games played. Starting to look a little bit more competitive. There's more travelling around. Starting to resemble more modern football. Same goes for the year after in 1911, where they pretty much walked the league, winning 12 out of 16 games, qualifying for the national final, where they destroyed Vicenza over two legs, 5-1. After this, when you go to 1912, this was their last championship for a while, I believe, where, again, it's a bigger league. There's 10 teams now. There's 18 games. They destroy the league again, like coming, they finished top and qualifying for the final. And this is the biggest victory, the biggest margin of victory, where they beat Venezia 13-0 over two legs. From there, they don't win a final again for another, so they don't win another championship for another 10 years. This is because largely to do with World War One, and there was a lot more tinkering with the league formats. For anybody who wants their brain scrambled, go and have a look on Wikipedia, go have a look at the format for the 1920-21 season, because it is unintelligible. It's really complicated. Essentially, Provincelli finished second in their first group. So there were two stages, two group stages. Provincelli finished second behind Alessandria, but romped through their second stage group, winning five of their games, qualifying for what was a two-tiered final, where they first beat Alessandria again, 4-0, and then beat Bologna 2-1 with an extra time goal. After that, there were more arguments, another league split, with this time with the creation of a new Italian federation. So now they were operating with two Italian federations. Provincelli entered into the more illustrious one, the CCI. It had bigger teams and is recognised today. It's still recognised as an official Scudetto. And this, I think, is the biggest achievement. It was the biggest league to date. Starting to look a bit more like modern football. 24 teams separated into two groups. 22 games, of which Provincelli won 17 of them, finishing top of their group by 16 points. They played Genoa in the final, who walked their group as well, and defeated them 2-1 over two legs to claim their seventh title and arguably the most impressive one. Now, we've touched on this a bit, but I think all this happens at a really interesting time in Italian history. Provincelli go on to become really influential during this time. They were invited on tours of South America and really heavily used as part of the national Italian conversation. Whether by choice, I don't know. But the success of the small club tied in very nicely with the growing nationalism in the country. So, like, even their nickname, Il Leone, the Lions, links in very nicely with nationalist talk. When Italy played their first ever international fixture in 1910, they apparently played in white as a nod to the colours of Provincelli. it all sort of represents the nationalism and direction of the country, what direction the country was going in at the time. For the Italian government, it was proof that the expensive foreign heavy city clubs like the Milans and Juventus weren't needed. It was possible for Italy to make champions of their own and in the smallest of towns.
Having listened to all of that, Stephen, and like I say, I was hoping that this is, you know, that this is what would come across, you know, in this podcast. And when you listen to sort of what Matt said there, and you know, you go from this almost, I can't even call it a provincial league, this, you know, this very first title that's won, and then you go to this final championship with, you know, it's 24 teams. I think it's 22 games, 16-point margin. It's, you know, all of a sudden you have a side that has won all of these league titles, yes, but they've sort of spanned, you know, we're talking there, you know, football's always changing, but, you know, the change that Italian championship football went through in that time span, you know, is incredible. And yet this team adapt from what is a, you know, a 14 provincial tournament to a 24 team tournament, and you know, and almost, which makes their achievements perhaps even greater than some of the, you know, maybe the more modern day. You know, you look at Juve now, and you know the amount of league titles that they're winning in a row. But there's not necessarily that need to adapt in such a way that Provincelli had to adapt.
No, and that's one of the great things about it is that need to adapt. They've not zoned at all. You know, they've gone through so many changes. There's been the what's basically a civil war, I suppose, when the two leagues, you know, split off. But then, you know, that's resolved, and they just bounce through every single deviation. And that's what they are. You know, we talk about tangents on these podcasts, and we'll start with something, but then, you know, we go off on tangents and it's all welcome. You know, this is the club of tangents. You know, they take every single change of system in their stride, and you know, they are the benchmark at that point in time. You know, part of the research I did for this podcast was that, you know, I was intrigued to see what impact they had on the national team, for instance. You know, this is an era before the World Cups come into play. This is an era where, you know, the Olympic Games kind of dictates who's the best team on the planet. You know, and high profile possible as friendlies that they can play. You know, and like 9 Provincelli players were in the Italian national side in 1913 for a game against Belgium. You know, it's things like this. This is an all-encompassing side that adapt as they move along, and it's quite startling, because the more that I looked at them, the more it's probably human nature for most people is that you look for some kind of mirror image of a football club or a player. You look for something to compare them to, and there is nothing really to compare them to. You know, if you're looking to try and compare them to an English team, you can turn around and say, well, yes, Preston were the early pace setters and they were, you know, a fine team, but they fell away. But yes, they fell away, but they also came back again and remained, you know, at least a top flight side until the 50s. This is a side that vanished in the 1930s off the highest plane of Italian football, never to return. You know, you could point to a Huddersfield Town and being so successful in the 1920s under Herbert Chapman. But, you know, Huddersfield have played top-flight English season in recent times, you know, and prior to that, they were a top-flight side in the early 70s. You know, this is not something that Provincelli can claim. They can't claim that, yes, we had our glory days between 1908 and 1922, and then we intermittently return to the top flight once every 20, 30 years for a season or two just to say hello and as a retro throwback and disappeared again. No, we're still awaiting this return of them. So yes, this great sense of mystery, but the fact that they were just such an all-encompassing side as well and such an omnipresent figure in the Italian game and have such an influence on the national team.
I'm going to come to you because I think this question is going to be right up your street, Gary. This one, okay. after the last one that I threw out at you, I think what also needs bearing in mind here as well is, you know, Matt's gone through sort of the upheaval of, you know, of Italian football, the organisation of Italian football, the fracturing and coming together of Italian football. But you also have to look at society in Italy at that time and what was happening. You know, Matt's, you know, mentioned there about Mussolini, you know, the fascist party. All of this happens within this incredible period of upheaval within Italian society.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, people are, if you asked anybody to name 20 Italian cities, Vercelli wouldn't be in there. And that's I mean, that might sound a little sort of fatuous, but there's a perfectly logical link to this discussion with that. It's a small town. And when the sort of industrial powerhouses of Milan, Turin, Rome became more prominent, the difference was that the money generated in those cities allowed the teams to the clubs in those sort of teams to overwhelm the talent that had been produced by this small town club. And it's interesting that Stevie mentions clubs like Huddersfield and similar to that. But I would always compare Provincelli to almost like Burnley. Before the maximum wage was abolished, Burnley were a successful, they were a small town club. They were successful because they were run very well and they promoted a good youth system, bringing players through. But when money came more and more into the game after the maximum wage was abolished, they struggled and couldn't compete. They were washed over by the flood of money. And I mean, I'd be interested if Matthew thinks this is right. I'm not sure if it is, but the sort of research I did around this era was that it's interesting. I want to perhaps ask Matthew later to sort of give us why Provincelli came to the fore. But does he agree that the sort of demise was because of the powerhouse teams of the bigger cities?
The way it all ended, and I think I'll get into this in a minute, but Provincelli's biggest strength kind of became their weakness in the way that how it ended, because they were the first modern Italian club. They were the sort of the first to do training methods, to have real training methods, to train the players to be a bit more possession-based. Their youth academy was incredible, as Stevens touched on. They were the first model Italian club, I think, and the bigger, richer clubs could take this model and then build on it in ways that Provincelli couldn't. I mean, Vercelli is like a really tiny town. It's really quite a poor town as well. Like, the population now is less than 50,000, so I'm sure it was smaller in the early 20th century. And they were competing with like the giants of Milan and Turin. I don't think it's a coincidence that all of their titles came before the 1929 season, which is, I think, considered to be the first Serie A season. The Milan and Turin clubs had too much money, so there was no way of this tiny provincial town like competing with that. But again, it's like you said, and that's what makes the story so amazing and so fascinating, is this tiny, tiny club dominating Italy for such a huge amount of time. 5 out of 6 championships is scarily good. But it's like with most things, though, isn't it? Like, money talks.
It is. And you know, as Gary's mentioned there, you know, about the money, and you know, you talk there about the more traditional powerhouses, certainly in northern Italy. But it ultimately, it's still about players, and it's still about, you know, you mentioned training methods there, Matt, and it's still about managers or coaches. You know, you've still got to have the personnel. In terms of Provincelli at this time, you know, in terms of protagonists, is there anybody who spans this entire period at the club?
Yes. So there's a player who, I'll touch again on some of the other players, but the one player who stands out as like the star of the club is a guy called Guido Adda, who I'm sure I'm pronouncing that name wrong. I'm sorry, Guido. But he was the star of the side. He was the dynamic midfielder who would become a one-club man. He was a player for the first 6 titles that Provincelli won, which means he was playing for like over a decade, 15 years. And from what I can make out, he also managed them in the 2021 season and the 21-22 season, which means that like it makes him the only man to be present at the club for all of the Scudettos, which is some achievement. And I really like this guy's story. He's like a walking symbol of Provincelli's success. But again, it's like Stephen mentioned, that's what makes this story so amazing, is that he was like really important for the Italian side. He got 13 caps and played at the 1920 Olympics for Italy. It's yeah, he's a really interesting story.
It, I mean, you know, Stephen, again, it's, you know, these are the, you know, I think this is, I'm not saying this is why we do podcasts and stuff, but I think these are the gems, these are the sort of stories that, you know, you talk about was going off on tangents and, you know, learning about players like this or learning about characters within the game and the history of the game, you know, and to span, you know, this entire period, it's, you know, it's something that should be celebrated.
Oh, it should be. And I think this was one of the most, I mean, from when I was reading through the other day about them and you know, Matthew's right, there's very little in the English language about them. So what you're doing is you're leading towards Italian websites and Italian articles and just using Google Translate and trying to decipher stuff. But yeah, you know, I tripped across Guido Ara and there were so many others as well that just stood out as these amazing kind of individuals that were just part of an amazing football club. It was like the Rampini brothers, you know, Carlo and Alessandro. You know, they won league titles galore. You know, and you know, Luigi Bazzino came, you know, tripped across another one, and it was like never heard of these figures, but they have such amazing stories. You know, he was a person that, you know, eventually became the three-time president of the FIGC, the, you know, the runners of the Italian game. He went on to be like vice president of FIFA. You know, you have you know, the bizarrest of instances where, like, the co-founder of the club itself, you know, went on and became a, you know, a gold medalist at the Olympics, but not through football, through fencing. You know, the club itself was born of a gymnastics club. It's just such a depth to them, a hidden depth, because, you know, no one knows anything about them. But then when you take the time to say, right, I'm going to open the front page of this club and see what's behind it, my God, there's some stories and some characters behind them. And, you know, they are, you know, an amazing football club that are hidden by time. But also the fact that they don't come from any kind of era where there's television footage of them. You know, we can't, you know, it's all before the World Cup kicks in. You know, so there's this amazing dividing line with football is that, you know, once the World Cup kicks in, it becomes a global game, and, you know, it's there as an omnipresent entity. But before that, there is such mystery about certainly the game away from the UK, from a British perspective. You know, it's that old story of it's the colonial Brits taking the game to the rest of the world. But then there's a big gap in knowledge, basically, of those early heroes of the game within these, you know, the various countries out there that have picked up football and ran with it spectacularly.
If I can just add something to that, I think you've mentioned something that I think is really important to this story, is that the fact that Provocelli were born out of a gym, which I think is a really important point as to why they were so, like, all dominating at the time, and something that establishes them as a pioneering club in Italy, I think. Their players were always younger, stronger, fitter than their opponents. Like, if you look at some of the teams at the time, I know Genoa's keeper was James Spensley, who's like one of the godfathers of football in Italy. But he was 40 at the time, where Provocelli players were all around 20 years old. They were essentially the first modern Italian club. They ran these tough drills in training where they actually practiced corners and free kicks, whereas other teams didn't. I've mentioned before, but they tried to control possession in games more so than their opponent. According to John Foote, the historian again, that superior fitness was the biggest attribute of the team. So they usually won games in the last 15 minutes when their opponents were tiring. And then the youth academy, which was, I think, sort of built in tandem with the gym, churned out an amazing amount of players. Like, I think somebody mentioned already how many players represented Italy, and they were all from this, like, nine of this of the Italian side in 1913 were from Vercelli, this tiny town. Another thing to add on to the Rampinis is a nice little anecdote about the Rampinis, because well, they were both prolific goal scorers. Alessandro Rampini scored 82 goals in 91 appearances. Carlo Rampini scored 106 goals in 99 appearances, which is like some ratio. And Carlo was the one who scored both goals in the 1908 final, like their first championship triumph. This is against Juventus. And he was rewarded with two cigars from the chairman, which he would then go on to sell to fund treatment for another teammate's brother who was ill and sick at the time, which I think is a nice little story that sort of must have encapsulated the team spirit they had at the time.
Just coming off that, Gary, do you think... This is a bit of a side issue and a side question here, but kind of links with what Matt's just been saying there. Do you think enough is done to protect or to retell these stories, either through, you know, higher authorities, be it FIFA, be it the Italian FA, whatever it is? But, you know, and it doesn't have to be specific to Italian football either. You know, I'm sure there are club sides, you know, around the world that... or there will be stories of clubs like this. But, you know, do you think enough is done? And Steve made a great point about, you know, television and, you know, where you have video clips and anything that's pre, it becomes very difficult to either contextualise or to generate people's interest if there are no visuals to go alongside the story.
I guess the short answer is no. You know, I mean, forgive me for speaking for you and Stevie and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but... my knowledge of Pro Vercelli, it was somewhere between 0 and 0.1 before I started doing a research on this because we're doing the podcast tonight. And so you know, I knew very little about this club, despite the success that they had. So I think the short answer is no, but you know, no, I'm sad because it's probably the case. It's the story of this club is probably so similar to so many other clubs where they become, there's a reason why they become a potent force in a national league, and there's a reason why that wanes and falls away. And, you know, it's interesting to hear that Matthew said about, you know, they were sort of revolutionary in the way that they're training, coaching. But once other clubs picked up on that, then that sort of advantage was sort of diminished, and then the more wealthy clubs and within the more wealthy cities took away that dominance, and you know, their strength almost became their weakness. And if football teaches anything, you know, periods of dominance, nothing is forever. And you know, Pro Vercelli should probably be remembered as a dominant club in Italian football, much as, you know, we talk about Juve in the modern sense, Milan when they were winning European cups on a regular basis, you know, the Grand Inter teams of the 60s. So to answer your question, yes, they should, but I think the answer is that they're not.
Well done, Gary. Great answer. But I knew if I threw it to you, you'd be okay with it. I knew you'd be able to cope with that.
Thanks,
Matt, just... with regards to, you know, and Gary's just mentioned there, you know, nothing is forever. And obviously the demise of this club, and it, you know, and it is a sudden demise. Obviously, you know, we're talking here about a club that not many people have heard of. So, you know, therefore you assume that this demise is quite sudden and quite dramatic. But obviously there's always the start of the demise. You know, there's always either a tipping point or a moment or a, you know, maybe it's a marginal decision. You know, there is always a point either where it starts to go wrong or there is potential to rescue the situation, but that potential is lost or failed to recognize. And then that becomes the moment when actually it all started to go wrong. In terms of the demise of this club, you know, were there, you know, moments where it could have been saved or it could have been brought back, or was the demise just completely inevitable?
I think the demise is inevitable purely because of what Gary says about how other teams had picked up on their training methods, had picked up on everything that made them stand out and made them the foremost team in the country, had been picked up on and was no longer an advantage. But there is, when you talk about like marginal decisions and certain things that indicate the decline, there's a player we haven't mentioned yet who, by this point, I think the decline had set in already, but Silvio Piola went through the Pro Vercelli Academy. And this is what I mean when I say that their greatest strength became their weakness, because Piola is the first great Italian striker and sort of widely thought of as one of Italy's greatest ever players. There's a really great article on the Leeds Football Times website written by Tom Scholes about Piola. He was this all-action striker who could do a bit of everything, but more than anything, the man scored goals. He's the highest goal scorer in Italian football history with 274 goals, something that seems unlikely to ever be beaten. He scored 30 goals in 34 appearances for the Azzurri, and an amazing stat here, but he's the highest scorer for three different clubs in Italian football, Provincelli, Novara and Lazio. And he went through the youth academy of Provincelli like so many before him. He made his debut for the club at the age of 17, scoring 13 goals in his first full season. He would go on to score 51 goals in 127 appearances for the club, and still holds the record for most goals scored in an Italian match when he scored 6 in a single match against Fiorentina. And he's their greatest player. He's who the stadium is named after. And considering his goal record, his breakthrough at such a young age, a lot of clubs were interested in him. But Provincelli always maintained that they would never sell him. And the president at the time said, "We will never sell Piola, not even for all the gold in the world. Once we sell him, the decline of Provincelli will begin." And he was totally right. Provincelli sold Piola to Lazio in 1934. A year later, Provincelli were relegated from Serie A with 15 points, and they've never been back since.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I know we seem to keep going about this, Stephen, but it's, you know, listening to Matt there, and you know, the story is, you know, as Matt's going through the story, you know, with us and for us, there are so many pointers that you can recognise, you know, in the very most contemporary of settings and situations. You know, the story of a player who comes through the youth team, who, you know, becomes, you know, an absolute star of Italian football, and then goes on to another club and, you know, and does the same again. You know, it's, you know, these stories just constantly keep coming back.
They do. You can always see those fault lines, you know, and Piola is kind of like the last hurrah of that. You know, he went on to win the World Cup with Italy in 1938. You know, this is, you know, which endorses the standing that Matthew has so eloquently, you know, afforded him there. And prior to that, there was another player called Virginio Rosetta, who kind of quite symbolically, Provincelli lose him within a year of their last championship success. To Juventus, and that's quite symbolic in itself, is that there's this passing of the baton. It's not just a player that's being passed from Provincelli to Juventus. It's impetus. It is the future now. You know, it's the old currency being transferred into the new currency, and yes, these fault lines, you know, and they are a recurring feature, and that's the great thing about doing these types of series. You know, Gary's political podcast series was, you know, evident of that as well, is that there are these repetitive themes that crop up, but with a different landscape, against a different landscape. And yeah, you know, these instances of the decline of a football club do become very, very obvious in hindsight, you know, with the pattern of how they work is almost like an identikit pattern.
It's, here you go, Gary, here's a question for you. Do you think, I've just thought of it now as Stephen was chatting there, we talk about patterns and we talk about history repeating itself. Are these stories always inevitable? And why are they inevitable? Why does history not teach us? Why does football not learn? Why do clubs not learn?
I think yes, they are inevitable because history tells us they are. You know, we can look at periods of domination in football. You know, Manchester United under Ferguson, Liverpool under Paisley and Shankly. Nothing's forever. Nothing is forever. If football teaches us anything, it teaches that nothing is forever. And like empires of any type, be it financial, be it military, be it dynastic, empires rise and they fall. Nothing's forever, and football is just another example of that. If you're asking me for why, it's because I think that what makes you great also makes you weak. And if Provincelli is a good example of this. You know, as Matthew is explaining to us, you know, the reason they came to prominence was because they were ahead of the pack with their method of coaching and developing young players and training and to make their players better. But once other teams saw what was happening, they copied it, and the advantages they had over Provincelli negated the lead that they had. And that's true of so many employees in so many different ways, in so many different genres, as I said, no matter whether it's military or financial or any other way, because people copy ideas. And what makes you, you know, it's a truism that what makes you great also makes you weak.
I knew you'd be able to answer that one for us. And clubs that are going through periods of dominance need to listen more to you.
Yeah, and it's true. You know, we sort of had a conversation about Liverpool on a podcast a week or so ago, and you know, with Jeff Golding, and Liverpool look like amazingly dominant force. You know, win the Premier League by 20 odd points. But I say, you know, Man City, Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal. If history of football teaches you anything, you know, it's that Liverpool won't be the top dog in 5 years' time because it doesn't work like that anymore. Steve might screen, that's fine. You know, you want to be the top dog, and you know, but football, it doesn't work like that. Things change, and nothing is forever, especially in football.
This story, Matt, is. You know, it's a wonderful story that you've brought to us. You know, like Gary said, nothing is forever, and this period of success was so prolific, and then the demise is so sudden and it's so severe. In terms of bringing this sort of story up to date, you know, has there been any, you know, have they threatened to return? You know, have they ever looked like coming back? I mean, I'm obviously not regaining completely former glories, but have they ever looked like coming close to re-establishing themselves?
Honestly, no. It's something that makes the whole story a bit more heartbreaking and adds a bit more like a layer of romanticism to the titles that they did win. Because this crazy successful team, one of the pioneering teams of Calcio, and they've been stuck in CVD and CVC pretty much ever since 1935. I was dreading this bit of the pod because I feel I need to explain a little bit about CVC and CVD, and they are just like some of the most elaborately confusing constructed leagues in Europe. But so Provincelli were semi-professional for a long time, and they dallied with bankruptcy in the mid-2000s, like a lot of Italian teams, and they've been trying to navigate this system ever since. So nine teams are relegated from Serie C, with nine from CVD replacing them. To add some levels of terror, there are various levels of playoffs. It's essentially Serie C and Serie D are like a footballing gauntlet. And considering that, again, small town, real, no money, it took them 64 years of yo-yoing between divisions for Provincelli to get back to Serie B, where they lasted a season. And they've been sort of, since then, that was in 2012, they've been sort of yo-yoing between Serie B and Serie C ever since. Last season, they were managed by Alberto Gilardino, which is a very recognisable name. But it didn't exactly go well, and they were probably glad that the league was postponed when it was, because they were 14th when the league was cancelled, 2 places and 4 points ahead of the relegation places. Gilardino is left now, and Francesco Modesto is the mister in charge now. They've got a fairly decent squad, I think. They've made some interesting signings, like signing some loan players from Crotone and Napoli. And they actually beat Torino in a friendly the other day. But Serie C is a minefield, and it's like an incredibly difficult league to navigate. It's a long road back to Serie B. But I really hope they do it. I mean, like I said, I've developed like a genuine affection for the club, and I wish there was more information available about them in English, because I feel like there's still so much to explore and to find out about their glory years, or even sort of the darker years spent in Serie D. And I struggle to think of a club that's had a dramatic history as Provincelli's to go from this all-dominating side to a struggling Serie C side. Honestly, I don't think I've seen anything like it football before. But this is maybe my question to you guys now, because I think it raises some interesting questions, especially about what it means to be a big club. Because I'm sure if you were to ask fans of Villa, Forest, Huddersfield, you know, are you a big club? They would point to all the titles and the cups they won and say, hell yeah, we're a big club. Provincelli has a similar amount of titles as a big club, as those clubs, sorry. Can they do the same? Can they say that we are a big club?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, it's one of those, I mean, I know someone who swears that there's only kind of like six truly big clubs, you know, and they're very defined in how they refer to a big club. But, you know, for me, yes, you know, a Provincelli can at least claim to be a club with a big history, if not to be a big club. I don't think there is a club comparable to Provincelli in this respect. Is that, like I say before, that, you know, Preston have come back from, you know, the depths of despair to come knocking on the door of the Premier League. You know, they still reach an FA Cup final as late as 1964. Huddersfield have had a recent season or two in the top flight. They did so in the 70s. You know, Bolton Wanderers, another one who've you know, were so important to the early days of English football and have come back at various times. You know, they've dropped back down to the fourth tier again, but, you know, there's no saying that they won't be back again. So, yes, you know, I think there's a defined line in being able to say you are a big club in a contemporary manner. You know, you look at a PSG, for instance, they didn't exist until 1970. They are a big club, you know, but more so in contemporary terms than anything else. So, yes, it's probably the best way to describe it would be that Provincelli are a club with a big history.
Gary, you know, I mean, you know, similar question, I suppose, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm not for a minute saying, you know, Chelsea aren't a big club, but you know, you look at almost Provincelli and Chelsea's story and they're almost flipped, you know, in terms of, you know, one was 100 years ago and is well and truly over. The other one is, you know, is incredibly contemporary and is of this century. And they are still very much in it, you know. Are both of them classed as, or can both of them be classed as big clubs?
Okay. It's a good question, Steve. Firstly, I would never argue with anybody who says their club's a big club, because beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and you can define it however you want to. You know, I could probably reel off 10, 15, 20 clubs whose fans would say they're a big club. I'm not sure what it even means, to be honest with you. Chelsea, okay, we won the championship in 1955. We won it in 2005. Every 50 years, we won the championship. We're a big club. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. Provincelli, I think they had more than a brief success, and I think that this probably is what raises clubs from the ordinary to the celebrated. And it almost doesn't matter when that period was. Does it matter if it was in the 80s? Does it matter in the 20s? Does it matter in the 50s? Does it matter if it's in the 2020s? I think the short answer is no. If you're successful, you're successful. If you're successful for the long term, you build in that that cachet that makes you respected, and rightfully so. I think it's difficult to give a definitive answer to what makes a great club, what makes a big club, who's a big club. Is it defined by success? Is it defined by how many fans you bring in? Is it defined by how long you survive in the big league? Is it defined by how many cups you win? Is it defined by success on a domestic basis? Is it defined by success on a European basis? And I think the answer is, it's all of those things. And if you want to choose to define your club in any of those criteria, then that's fine. So big clubs are what you define, and that's okay.
What about you, Matt? You know, where do you sit on the? I know it was your question. I'm really sorry. I have just hijacked it, and I got a bit frightened when you said you were going to ask us all the questions. So I've hijacked it. Where do you sit with this? You know, with this big club discussion, debate, criteria, and you know, and what part does you know, I suppose, you know, as Gary said, there's lots of different elements, you know, and history has to be one of those elements, but how, in, you know, how important is history?
Yeah, I agree with, I think Gary said that it's quite a modern day football question. You know, people arguing on Twitter about who's a bigger club, and it's like you said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's like, it's all about who you support and what you think about your club, and I agree with that especially. And I agree with what Stephen said about having, you know, it's a Trevor Shelley of a club with a big history. And I agree with that. I think, I just think it's a bit of a shame when it comes to Trevor Shelley how they are this sort of pioneering club in Italy, and they don't seem to be remembered very often or remembered much at all, really. Like, I'm sure in, I can't speak for Italy, to be fair, but I'm sure, like, there's people in Italy that don't even know who they are and don't know anything about the fact that this, you know, this tiny club from this tiny town that has, you know, the town is famous or known for cultivating rice, not football, but this town has 7 titles. So yeah, I think I'm glad I was asking it, to be honest, that question. But I do wish that there was more knowledge about Provincelli and a bit more that they deserve to be a bit more celebrated, I think.
It's, I mean, you know, I suppose, you know, we've already, you know, been chatting for an hour on this topic, which I've got to say, when you first sent me it across, Stephen, I didn't think we'd be able to do that. However, clearly, you know, and as Matt just said there, there's so much more to learn about this club. And, you know, I suppose, you know, we've had the discussion of, you know, of what constitutes a big club, you know, but I suppose some, you know, the final question, and I'll ask all three of you this, so you can get ready. But who would you liken them to? It doesn't have to be in this country. It can be, you know, in any of the European or world leagues. It can be in this country. But if you were trying to draw some sort of contextualized comparison for this club to finish with, you know, who would you look to?
Ooh. That's yeah.
You got there first. I'm really sorry. The other two are now. The other two are sat there going
busy you, thinking. Yeah.
You have got thinking time. sorry.
Yeah. No. I'll still say, like I said before, I think they're incomparable to absolutely anyone else. Yes, you can point to, you know, the glory days of Preston North End being predominantly in the 1880s and 1890s. You can point to Bolton's wondrous successes of the 1920s in the FA Cup. You can point to, you know, Herbert Chapman fueled Huddersfield Town. But unrelated to them completely is that they all had some kind of at least brief renaissance or two along those years. They bobbed back up towards the top and then drifted back down the ladder again. Provincelli have never done that. They rose spectacularly and then sank virtually without trace, you know, never to be seen in the higher levels again. So, you know, that I think that's as close as you can. You can maybe look to Spain in the pre-La Liga days. You know, in Spain, they didn't have a league as such prior to the La Liga, but they had the domestic cup. And, you know, names like Racing de Aron, Real Union, Arenas, they all tipped up and won cups and then played no significant role in the La Liga era. You know, so they're somewhere between those two concepts for me. You know, the Huddersfields, the Prestons of the English game, the Boltons, and then offset by the likes of Real Union in Spain.
Gary, I'm afraid you're next because Matt's the guest, so he gets longest to think, I'm afraid.
That's fine, but I just before we sort of, I'll give the answer, just interested to hear Matt say about the complexities of Serie A in the lower divisions. You want complexity, just look at the La Liga below Segunda B and then the complexities of that, and there you go to those leagues. That's complicated. But to answer your question, you know, I would say, I mean, you know, Stevie's right, the clubs he's mentioned, but I'd give it a more, at least semi-contemporary basis. I would sort of go back to the reference I gave earlier and say Burnley. Burnley were a club who were advanced in the way they coached, in the way they produced players, in the way they trained players, in the way they developed tactics. But once the maximum wage was abolished, the financial powerhouse of the larger city clubs overwhelmed them. And I think that's there's a metaphor there for how Provincelli both gained prominence and lost it afterwards because of the financial power of the larger city teams.
Well, I'll throw another one in there as well. You know, the similarities to say like a Borussia Mönchengladbach for the 1970s. You know, you look at BMG, or I think all but one of the major trophies were won during the 1970s. So yes, you know, they're still a top flight side, and you know, they've still remained relevant. They challenge for Champions League places nowadays. But you know, in an era of success, if you're looking for an era of success, that Provincelli era that went from 1908 to 1922, was that 14 years where all those honours are kind of crowbarred into that era. You know, you could look at a BMG who's, you know, 98% of their success is crowbarred within an era that stretches from 1970 to 1980.
Yeah, I think
Steve's right. We tried to sort of crowbar a sort of comparison that may not be there, but you know, the ones that Stevie mentioned, I say Burnley is, they're all elements of the same sort of issues that Provincelli faced and were overwhelmed by.
I think the close, I had a hunch and I just Googled it, and not quite the same, but Red Star of Paris, who I think they can claim to be like a pioneering club in France, you know, owned by Jules Rimet. And judging by their Wikipedia, thank you Wikipedia, they won a few Coupe de France in the 1920s. They won three in a row and another one in 1928. But they didn't win the league, and they didn't dominate an entire country in quite the same way as Provincelli did. I think that's the sort of the most comparison I can make. But I think I agree with what Steve said. I think Provincelli are pretty incomparable. I think I don't think I've ever read another or found another story like that, as like to go from such highs to such lows. I think Naz is a quite unique story.
It's a great way to finish, and I think, you know, you know, everything that you guys have said, you know, as always, which is why you guys do all the talking and I don't. I think, you know, I think you're right, you know, in terms of just because, you know, trying to make a comparison in terms of it being nearly 100 years ago, actually, what you're looking for is an incredibly intense period of domination that then just falls away. That's ultimately the template that you're kind of looking at here. It's like I say, it's been a brilliant discussion, absolutely brilliant. Like I say, we're well over the hour. You know, fair play, Matt. It was a great story. It was a great story to bring to us. I was filled with trepidation, but it's been brilliant. You know, I've absolutely loved it. Loved listening. Loved learning. You know, the guy I always say, you know, when you get free education, this is how GCSEs should be delivered in this sort of format, be it political, historical, whatever it is, you know, this is how, you know, I'm sure GCSE pass rates will be, maybe not a lot higher, but if you could contextualise it into people's passions and interests, you know, then all the better. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful hour and a bit.
Ah, thanks for having me on. I'm glad you guys didn't ask too many more questions, because like I say, like basically everything we've talked about is all the information you can find about them. This is what I think makes them such a like fascinating and dramatic sort of story. It's like I said earlier, there's like the legend of Provincelli. It's like there's so little to read about them, so little to research. And I think it's an amazing story. So I think it's been really cool, really interesting to talk about it. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, Matthew.
Stephen, as good as you thought it would be?
Yes, and so much more. You know, Matthew's done us proud there. You know, brought us a curveball, but he's delivered it beautifully.
He absolutely has. Gary, like we say, always love learning, don't we?
Absolutely, Mike. And, you know, big up to Stevie for the idea of this series, and massive thanks to Matthew for increasing knowledge. Well, producing knowledge of a club that I'd never heard of before. And I'm so much, my football knowledge is so much better for this conversation tonight.
Brilliant. Well, there's no better way, and there's no better way to finish than that. Hopefully, obviously, everybody who's sort of tuned in and, you know, and listened to this, you know, hopefully they've learned. Hopefully, they'll go away, you know, and start to look and learn, you know, about this club, or maybe start to look and learn about the history of the game a little bit more. Maybe, you know, as we said, these stories are so important that are kept alive. The stories of players, stories of clubs, and I think, without getting on my soapbox here, but I'm going to. You know, I think all of us who love football almost have a responsibility to keep these stories alive, and, you know, and to keep them going. And if we don't do them, we can't, you know, we can't moan that nobody else does either. So, you know, I think it's really important that if you are a fan of football, or you love the game, that, you know, you almost have a responsibility, a part responsibility as well, to keep all of the stories alive. You know, the whole history of the game, and not just, you know, just live in the here and now.
All right, Stu. Quite right, Matt.
Thank you. Yeah, like I say, Matt, brilliant, wonderful, wonderful. Please come on again. Obviously, if you can find out another hour's worth of information about this club, please let us know. and we'll happy to have you back on for a part two.
Bromwich Albion expert is a niche area, but I'm one I'm happy to fill.
Excellent. And obviously, all that's left for me to say. Is thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.